This morning I'm going to read from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, starting at verse 12 and then reading chapter 2. If you want to follow it in your church Bibles, it's on page 670. 670. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this, too, is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does it accomplish? I tried cheering myself up with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of trees and fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I brought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor. And this was the reward for all my toil. Yet, when I surveyed all my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise have eyes in their heads, while the fool walks in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless. For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of its meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. and who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish? Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil, into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God, for without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Amen.
I discovered this week that 7:26 p.m. on a Saturday night is officially the happiest time of the week. I don't know if you knew that. That was the finding of a poll that was conducted recently. 7:26 on a Saturday night is officially the happiest moment of the week. It achieved this accolade because by that point at a weekend, most people have had time to unwind after a week at work. However, predictably, the poll also showed that 7:29 a.m. on a Monday morning is the unhappiest time of the week. Fairly predictable, isn't it? I wonder, when are you at your happiest? In what situation? At what time? Doing what? When are you at your happiest? We all want to be happy, don't we? Let's be honest. The 17th century philosopher Blaise Pascal said, "All men seek happiness. This is without exception. Whatever different means they use, they all tend to this end." And let's be honest, our search for happiness is a good thing. It's a good instinct. A number of recent studies have shown that there are lots of benefits to being happy. Happy people have lower blood pressure, a better immune system, are less likely to get sick, tend to live longer, and have healthier relationships because they tend to make those around them happier as well. Happiness is a good thing to seek after. So the obvious question is, well, how do you get it? Where should you look for it? Well, that's what Ecclesiastes chapter 2 is all about. Because we see here where we should and shouldn't look for happiness. We saw it last week, and we started last week a series in Ecclesiastes. It's going to take us up to Christmas and beyond. And we saw that Ecclesiastes is written by someone who calls himself the teacher. And this teacher is identified in chapter 1, verses 1 and verse 12, as the son of David and king over Israel in Jerusalem. That's how he identifies himself. And really, the only person who fits that description in the Old Testament is Solomon, who was given great wisdom by God to rule over Israel. But despite his wisdom, we read in 1 Kings how his heart was turned away from God. And the result, it would seem, it's been suggested, was Ecclesiastes. Written by an older, wiser, repentant King Solomon, his purpose is to warn us not to make the same mistakes that he did. And so in chapter 2, he chronicles his search for happiness. But before he shares his own personal testimony, the teacher issues a spoiler at the end of chapter 1. He kind of tells us the conclusion of this search in advance. Look at verse 12 again. The teacher was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all the things that are done under the heaven. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Solomon kind of lays the ground, he prepares us for what he's about to share in chapter 2 by telling us that his search for happiness just brought him sorrow. It was meaningless. It was a chasing after the wind. Again, as we saw last week, the Hebrew word translated meaningless is a metaphor. It's a picture, it's an image. It means mist or breath or vapor or smoke. The teacher says, searching for forever happiness in our fallen world is ultimately futile. It's like trying to hold on to steam coming out of a kettle. In verse 14, again in verse 17, he says it's like chasing after the wind. And look, we all know the truth of that, don't we? We've experienced that in our own lives. We don't like to be blunt about it, but it's true, isn't it? We all experience moments and seasons of happiness in life. Maybe you're in one now. But they don't last forever. The bubble eventually bursts, doesn't it? And then we look for somewhere else for happiness. Or we get bitter because we haven't got it anymore. But why does the bubble burst? Why is that the case? Well, the teacher tells us in verse 15 of chapter 1. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. Happiness is hard to hold on to because we live in a crooked world. A crooked world that doesn't add up. The Bible tells us that the world was created perfectly good, but it was bent out of shape by our rebellion against God. Our sin kicked us and our world out of alignment with God. And while we continue to reject him, things are crooked. Things can't be straightened out. And things like happiness are hard to find. The inevitable result, you see, of this breach in our relationship with the God who made us to know him is a struggle for joy. A struggle to be happy. We were made to know God. And so while we're separated from him, we're never going to find the happiness we long for, the joy we long for, the forever joy. And that's what the teacher experiences in chapter 2. In verse 18, he introduces his own search for happiness with this summary statement. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. It's a bit of a spoiler, isn't it? Doesn't draw you into chapter 2, really, does it? As the teacher goes on to show us in chapter 2, if we look in the wrong place, our search for happiness results in sorrow, in grief, in misery. And yet, stick with us, because he does eventually discover that it is possible to find lasting happiness, even in a crooked world, if we look in the right place. However, he starts with the bad news. Firstly, he shows us from painful personal experience that happiness is hard to find because we look in all the wrong places. In chapter 2, the teacher conducts a happiness experiment. That's probably the best way to sum up what he does in this chapter. He searches for happiness in three different sources. First of all, he turns to pleasure. He asks, can pleasure make me happy. Verses 1 to 11, the teacher tries out everything. One writer says, within the house of hedonism, there are many rooms and Solomon tries to sleep in all of them. And that's what we get really in verses 1 to 11. But as Solomon discovers, as the teacher discovers, none of these sources of pleasure that are listed in verses 1 to 11 actually make him happy for very long. They make him happy for a little while. They give him delight for a little while, but it doesn't last. Just look at verse 1 of chapter 2. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. And here we go. This is the experiment test, the happiness experiment. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself from the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well. The delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all of this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and all that I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Now, the list of things that the teacher indulges in those verses is impressive, isn't it? He really did try everything. Verses 2 and 3, just follow it through with me. Verse 2 and 3, he hits the comedy clubs and the wine bars. He pursues laughter and wine, probably to excess, as indicated in that by the reference in verse 3 to embracing folly. That suggests drunkenness, doesn't it? He tried the comedy clubs and the wine bars to excess. In verses 4 to 6, he embarks on a range of ambitious building projects. He becomes a project manager. Houses, vineyards, gardens, orchards, reservoirs. Huge building projects. Verses 7 and 8, he amasses great wealth and power, acquiring vast numbers of servants and record-breaking herds and flocks of animals and stockpiling vast quantities of silver and gold. This is where wealth and power came from in those days. He had it all. Verse 8, he indulges his senses. He buys a band and hires a harem. He indulges in music, loud music and lots of sex, we might say. In 1 Kings 11, we're told Solomon had 300 concubines. He tried it all. And in doing all this, we're told in verse 9, he also acquires fame and status. He becomes greater than anyone else in Jerusalem. Verse 10, he admits he denied nothing his eyes or his heart desired. He throws himself into a hedonistic pursuit of pleasure. But after trying everything, and he's very honest, isn't he, in verse 10, my heart took delight in all my labor. There was some happiness in this. There were moments of delight, moments of joy, moments of happiness, moments of enjoyment. And yet, after trying everything, and looking back on it, in verse 11, his conclusion is stark. Nothing was gained under the sun. While these pleasures gave him a temporary kick, didn't last. None of them gave him a sustained sense of satisfaction, contentment, and ultimately happiness. He was left feeling empty. Can you identify with that? And so from verse 12, he turns to success. He asks, can success make me happy? Look at verse 12. So I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. Now, in the Bible, wisdom is about living successfully in a fallen world. It's about making good decisions and life choices in a fallen world and not being a fool, not being foolish. And when it came to ruling well and wisely, Solomon's dad, David, was the epitome of that. He was the greatest of Israel's kings. He ruled well and wisely. And so in verse 12, Solomon describes how he tried to follow in the footsteps of his father, under whose reign Israel had flourished and prospered and grown. If he could emulate his father's success and reign wisely, he would be able to look back on a life well lived and not wasted. Maybe he could find happiness and success. But then in verse 14, it dawns on him. It doesn't matter whether he succeeds or fails as a king, actually, because one day he'll die. Whether he's wise or foolish, doesn't really matter. The outcome will be the same. All the success in the world won't insulate him from death. Look at verse 14. The wise have eyes in their heads while the fool walks in darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless. For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. Death, says the teacher, comes to all of us and it renders every success null and void. 100 years from now, any wisdom we've demonstrated or successes we've enjoyed in our lives, on the court and sport, in our careers, at work, at home with the kids, any successes we've enjoyed in life will be forgotten. So the teacher's conclusion in verse 15 is, well, what then do I gain by being wise? What do I gain? When it came to pleasure, the teacher said, nothing has been gained. When it comes to success, the teacher says, what have I gained by being wise? Successful life. Well, that isn't the source of lasting happiness either. And so from verse 17, the teacher turns to work. He's trying it all, isn't he? He asks, can work make me happy? Maybe the satisfaction of a job well done is the way to be happy. Maybe hard work is its own reward. You heard those phrases said, haven't you? But no, you know the answer already, don't you? In verses 17 to 23, the teacher discounts that avenue as well. And once again, it is death, the reality of death, that bursts the bubble. Because the reality of death means we don't get to enjoy the fruit of our labours for very long. When we die, we end up handing on all we've worked for to others who might well squander or reverse or supersede all that we've worked for. Look at verse 17. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish? Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labour under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. Look, the logic, the teacher's logic is depressing, isn't it there? But it's actually also quite convincing. Why work hard? Why have that lovely phrase at the end there, anxious, even at night, their minds do not rest? Have you had that experience before? You can't sleep because you're thinking about the things you've got to do, the work you've got to do. That anxiety that comes from that sometimes. Why work hard? Why put long hours? Why make sacrifices at work, in career, for your career, if you're only ever going to then hand it on to someone else who's going to benefit from all that you've earned or achieved and who might well blow it all? And all you get is the gold watch. What's the point? And so the teacher's conclusion in verse 22 is, well, what do people get for all their toil? What's the point? Pleasure, success, hard work. The teacher throws himself into each one, and yet the result of his happiness experiment is the same in each case. As he gave us the headline at the end of chapter 1, sorrow and grief. Verse 11 of chapter 2, when it comes to pleasure, nothing was gained under the sun. Verse 15, when it came to success, what then do I gain by being wise? Verse 22, when it comes to work, what do people get for all their toil? And the answer in each case is nothing. Nothing. A temporary delight, temporary happiness, temporary kick, but not what we're really looking for. Forever happiness. The teacher's stark conclusion is that we cannot gain forever happiness by our own efforts. But in verse 24, he says, all is not lost. Because while happiness cannot be gained, it can be found. And that's because, secondly, happiness is a gift from God. We find it when we recognize or see his goodness. After declaring that life is futile, the teacher does what seems to be a complete 180-degree about turn in verse 24 by urging us to enjoy life. Look at verse 24. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? Now, this seems a complete change of tune, doesn't it? And the key to understanding why the teacher changes tune here is seeing the change in perspective that he urges us to adopt. Five times in verses 17 to 23, the teacher complains about the pointlessness of life under the sun. His focus is what's on life under the sun, on this world alone. But in verse 24, he shifts his focus. His point of reference moves away from life under the sun to upwards to God. And the result is a completely different way of looking at the world and of life. The secret to happiness in this fallen world, he says, is recognizing the good hand of God in the ordinary things of everyday life that we so often take for granted. If you want to be miserable, be entitled. If you want to be happy, be grateful. Be thankful. For the ordinary, everyday things of life that come from the hand of God, such as, he suggests, the provision of food and drink and work. These things, he says, come from the hand of God. And recognizing this and cultivating thankfulness for these everyday, ordinary gifts is one of the ways to be happy in a fallen world. Now, look, we could add to this simple list in verse 24 a whole bunch of other ordinary, everyday things that we so often take for granted today. Shelter, warmth, family, friendship, a good conversation, a refreshing walk, a bracing run. Let me know how that feels like. A well-written novel, a gripping film, a catchy song, or an uplifting beat, a competitive game, a close match, fine wine, or a real ale, or an ice-cold Coke. Take your choice. These are just some of the ordinary, everyday things that fill our lives every day that we so often take for granted. If we've learned anything from the last 18 months, surely it's how many of these things we take for granted and that we miss when they're not there. But the teacher says to us, stop. Stop in the busyness of your life and just think for a moment. Where do all these things come from? These are good gifts from the hand of a good God who gives them to us for our enjoyment and for our happiness. If you're searching for happiness, he says, look in the right place. Look to the source of happiness. This is why, for generations, Christians are given thanks before a meal. It's an ordinary, everyday thing, our daily bread, we might say. And yet it's a great habit to have, because it reminds us, at least once a day, to be thankful for the everyday, ordinary things that God provides. For searching for happiness, the teacher says, look in the right place. Look to the source of happiness. Verse 26, to the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. In his book on Ecclesiastes, David Gibson says this: this is the main message of Ecclesiastes in a nutshell. Life in God's world is gift, not gain. And that seeing life from those two different perspectives makes all the difference. If life is gain, if it's what I get, if it's my toiling that gets stuff, I feel entitled. It's my right. And if I don't have it, I feel bitter and resentful. If it's a gift, then I'm thankful and grateful. Last week we saw that God is sovereign, even over a fallen world. But at the end of chapter 2, the teacher reminds us that God is also good. And if we have the eyes to see it, God reminds us of his goodness every single day by providing us with so many ordinary gifts for our enjoyment. So let's not take them for granted. Let's be thankful people. But of course, we have a greater reason to be thankful today than even Solomon did, don't we? Because while God's goodness is seen in the ordinary gifts he gives, supremely it was seen in the extraordinary gift that God gave us. John chapter 3, verse 16, Jesus said, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. You see, God's goodness was supremely seen in the extraordinary gift of Jesus, who came to give his life and pay our penalty, to wipe clean our debt of sin, the sin that separates us from the God who made us, so that we might be reunited with God. No wonder then that Paul declares in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 15, thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. And that should be our response as well. Seeing and responding to God's extraordinary, indescribable gift is the first step towards finding forever happiness. We will never be happy if we continue to reject the God who made us for himself and seek gain from this world. We just need to read Ecclesiastes 2 to see that. In verse 26, the teacher is clear. God is the one who gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. So we'll never find forever happiness until we turn in faith to him and respond to his greatest gift in Jesus. But in verse 26, the teacher makes it clear we are free to choose. Look again at verse 26. To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. You see, the teacher says we're free to choose. We can either please God by turning in faith to him and accepting the gift of friendship he offers us in Jesus, and then living with thankful, grateful hearts for all the things, the gifts he gives us. Or we can continue to reject him and continue searching for happiness in all the wrong places. But if we continue to reject Jesus, then our search for happiness will continue to be a chasing after the wind. We will spend our lives, he says, accumulating, only to leave everything behind to others one day. But if we respond with thankfulness and faith to the extraordinary gift that God gave of his Son, and then cultivate a daily habit of thankfulness for all the everyday gifts he continues to give us, then we can find happiness, yes, even in a fallen world. In his book on Ecclesiastes, theologian Philip Ryken says this: you were made with the capacity to be one of the happiest beings in the universe, but you will never find it by living for your own pleasure. You will only find it when you learn to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Can I ask you, have you been looking for happiness in all the wrong places, even as a believer? Turn to the source of happiness today and put your trust in him. Let's pray as the musicians come up. Father, thank you for the many evidences we have every day that you are good and that you care for us. Thank you for our daily bread, for the food and drink and meaningful activity that you give us every day for our enjoyment. Lord, in our excess as Western Christians, it is so easy to take these things for granted, to forget that they are gifts from your hand. Stop us from being entitled people, bitter people, resentful people. Help us to see your daily kindnesses to us. Help us to be better at cultivating that daily habit of thankfulness that results in happier hearts and more joyful outlooks. But Father, while we thank you for your ordinary gifts, we thank you most of all for your indescribable gift, your most extraordinary gift, the gift of the Lord Jesus. Thank you that in him we have a restored relationship with you now and the prospect of eternal happiness in your presence one day. So help us to choose joy this week as we remember that you are unfailingly good, even when life is hard. We praise you in the name of Jesus. Amen.